UFO abductions, of course, are the thing which is very much the in vogue subject. And I suppose, to some extent, there's a kind of feeling of deja vu or, oh no, not again. And I sympathise with that if that's the way you're feeling about this whole subject. However, I hope that to some extent, and certainly for most of you, the way that we're going to look at the abduction experience over the next few minutes will be a different approach. Not necessarily a radical approach, and from where I come from in Britain, it's a fairly common approach. It's the sort of way that we tend to interpret it. I think it's a kind of cultural difference, and the way in which we evaluate UFOs from nation to nation does differ. And I don't think there's anything wrong with that. We can learn from one another. We should be prepared to do that. Nobody has a monopoly on truth. Nobody can say that they know what the answer is. And even though the title of the book says UFO abductions, abductions, the mystery solved, perhaps there should be a question mark in that title. But certainly, I don't want to make any pretentious claims that that is what we have done. We're making some progress towards an answer, and I think that is really as far as we will find that we've gone. We'll look at this in a visual sense. I think that's the best way to do it rather than me just waffle on, because I have a tendency to do that. I don't know how well you can actually see these slides, because I can't see them very well at all from here. So that's probably because of the lights, but if you want any more lights down, that's fine by me. Okay? Fine. Right, now this is, as you probably recognise, a scene from Steven Spielberg's Close Encounters of the Third Kind. And it's the way in which we would typically associate the abduction experience in a kind of fictional, mythical way. It's nice, friendly, what I like to call intergalactic cavalry riding in to the rescue of mankind. And it's the sort of scenario that we often associate with the abduction experience. However, next slide please. This in fact is how the media handle the abduction experience, totally differently. They perceive it as a subject which they can sensationalise. They want to scare people. And in effect, they've taken the same phenomenon, the same set of experiences, and turned it on its head. So they talk about terror, use words like that to describe it. Now, in a sense, that is based on the truth, because that is what witnesses do tend to describe. They say that the experiences which happen to them are frightening. They say that they are traumatic. Yet, at the same time, there's a kind of element of awe and an aura of mystique about them as well. And this immediately brings us to the heart of the whole phenomenon, because it shows that there's a kind of a split. Half of the evidence goes in one direction, half of the evidence goes in another. Is it an awe-inspiring experience, or is it a terrorizing experience? Now, of course, you all recognize this photograph, and I have to be very careful what I say about situations like this, the photograph of our old friend George Adamski, who is there really to represent the contactee movement from the 1950s. And to pose the question, is there a difference between what was going on 30 years ago and what is happening now? Are abduction experiences something which has been concurrent throughout the UFO phenomenon since it first entered its modern phase in 1947? Or is it something which has changed dramatically, a new thing which has only begun over the past 20 or 30 years? And the key to that question lies in these cases, these contactee reports, which happened to a very large extent in that period of the early 1950s to the late 1950s. There are similarities, there's no doubt. Anybody who's seen some of the modern-day abductees, particularly the ones who approach it with a kind of evangelical zeal, will realise that, however sincere they may be, they are, to a very large extent, modern-day contactees, because they believe that the experience that they've had has imparted into them a message which they then have to get across to other people. And that, in effect, is what the contactee philosophy is all about. However, there are also differences, because in the contactee stories such as George Udowski's, generally speaking, the interaction between the witness and the phenomenon was voluntary. That is, it wasn't an enforced experience. And modern-day abductions are typified by the fact that they are, in effect, kidnapped. The entities take the witness by force. So there is a crucial difference, as well as, to some extent, similarities. Again, you see, we recognise that this isn't really a straightforward, simple problem. And it's very easy to sort of put ourselves into a polarised state of mind, whereby we interpret the evidence in the way that we want to interpret it. So we must try and guard against that. It's always tempting to do it, because we all have our own ideas about what is going on. And we may be no more right than anybody else. Inevitably, therefore, we're going to colour our thinking to some extent and accept certain evidence and reject other evidence. And we have to do our best to avoid that tendency. In Britain, this philosophy of contacteeism during the 1950s took its most visible form through this society, the Aetherius Society, which is still very active today, and I think reflects the sort of only aspect of contacteeism which still flourishes over there. And in fact, it's still seen to a very large extent as representative of the UFO movement in Britain. They are often quoted in the media. They are treated as a UFO research group, and they are perceived as ufologists. Ufologists don't perceive them as ufologists, I would hasten to add. And there's a kind of uneasy truce which exists between the two sides. The difference is that, of course, the Aetherius Society don't investigate UFO sightings. And I mean, I know this because I've done radio programs with them and television programs, and I've tried to talk basic philosophy with them. And they admit that, effectively, they are a channel, in the same way as many people here today are reporting channeling experiences of their own. And therefore, they don't actually need to investigate individual reports. They are effectively there to spread a message, and are more akin to a religious movement than they are to a UFO research society, which is an interpretation of the phenomenon, not necessarily any better or any worse than the philosophy of an investigator or an investigative group, which I freely admit at this point that is basically what I am. I am not an abductee, I'm not a contactee, I'm not a channel or anything like that. I am effectively an investigator. I was trained as a science teacher. I investigate UFO reports and abduction experiences from the point of view that witness says this is what happened to me. I therefore have to evaluate that experience, document it, see how much of it can be verified, and then look for patterns and parallels between them. There's our old friend George. He lives out here on the west coast in California, and has done for a few years. And the British branch of the Aetherius Society, which is still its sort of heart, is now organised by a youthful team of very vigorous and very dedicated people who certainly know their ufology. And we also have peculiar sidelights to this whole contactee stroke abduction scenario in Britain. And this is one of them. This is, in Britain we have a sort of annual ritual, which I think is a bit like your Miss America beauty pageant that's on this week. And we call it the Eurovision Song Contest. Now the idea of this is that every nation in Europe, and I literally mean every nation, is supposed to have a competition on its television channel to elect a song to represent the country. And then, on one dreadful night of the year, they actually parade all of these songs. Now, they are not actually proper songs. I mean, no self-respecting songwriter would go anywhere near this contest. So, it's one of these worst talent shows on earth competitions, whereby everybody who thinks they can write a great song tries to write one and enters it, and this enormous competition goes on forever, and ultimately it's all whittled down, and you have to sit through about 5 hours of this storage being endlessly big now. I mean, occasionally it's very, very nice songs, and occasionally the performers do become international celebrities. The pop group ABBA actually started in this way, and their first hit record was the winner of the Eurovision Song Contest, but 9 times out of 10 it is instantly forgettable. However, a couple of years ago, this chap, whose name was Ricky Peebles, entered the competition and won the British Heat and became Britain's entry for this Eurovision Song Contest. But there was a twist to this, because he said that the song that he was singing, which was entitled Only the Light, was a straight translation of his own Close Encounter. And the words had actually been given to him by the aliens with which he was an actual child. And they had promised him faithfully that he was going to win the competition for Britain. The one thing this did teach us about the whole UFO phenomenon is that whatever else aliens may be, they're rotten songwriters, because Britain came 13th out of 17 entries that year, which is the worst performance we've had for about the last decade. So I don't think we're going to be using any channelers in the near future. But all seriously, this of course is, as Antonio was saying before, the key case in the whole abduction experience, Betty and Barney Hill. The reason why it's significant is not because it was the first abduction. As Antonio said, chronologically it wasn't. And even, to some extent, the Antonio Villas-Boas case wasn't the first abduction, because we have experiences dating back now quite a few years prior to Antonio Villas-Boas, which presumably what happened, even though they were usually reported later. Also, experiences which were reported at the time prior to Antonio Villas-Boas, which probably could have been abductions and simply didn't become full-blown abductions because the methodology to uncover them wasn't used at the time. And also, you've got all this problem of how should you interpret and evaluate ancient texts, mythological stories from a few centuries ago, even biblical texts if you want to. I did a radio program with a radio station in San Diego a few days ago, and it was quite interesting because I was saying the sort of things that I'm saying now. The presenter was intent on trying to persuade me, but what I really meant by this was that the Bible was the very first autobiography by an abductee. I certainly never thought of it in those terms before, and I'm still not sure exactly what he meant. But yes, you can do that. You can look back at old stories and interpret them in terms of abductions if you want to. But there is a danger of doing that, because the further back in time you go, the less we know about the sort of mindset of the people responsible for the text. And it's always dangerous to read into a situation things which probably weren't there in the first place and put onto it a stamp that's associated with our own common and current culture. So the reason why the Betty and Barney Hill case, which happened in September 1961, was important is because it was the case which manufactured the abduction phenomenon so far as society was concerned. Effectively, they were driving along a road, they saw something in the sky. This is Barney's sketch of what it was. And it was only later, when they got back, that they realised that there were stranger aspects to the story. And those stranger aspects emerged out of a kind of symbiosis. They didn't all emerge spontaneously. They came because the investigators said, now wait a minute, how long did this journey take? And gradually they realised that there was apparently a time lapse, because the journey home had taken longer than it should have done. There were mysterious physical marks, damage to the car, things like that. And a kind of prototype of what an abduction experience should be like was created, either spontaneously, because that's how the phenomenon was suddenly happening, or it was produced by investigators looking at the phenomenon in a different way. We don't know, and we've got to realise that we don't know and understand that questions like this, what impact investigators have on abduction experiences, do have to be asked. And I think we tend not to look at it from that point of view. We tend to assume that we are objective things like robots who are just pulling apart an experience of a human being, and we have laid bare the essence of the abduction experience. But that isn't what happens, because we are human beings interacting with another human being who has had a bizarre experience, and the ultimate experience that is described and enters into the literature of our field is a combination of those two people, usually meeting over a long period of time, sometimes working with doctors and psychiatrists and so on too. And inevitably, out of all that morass, the final story that emerges has got to have had some impact from the other people involved rather than the witness themselves. So we mustn't forget that point. Here's the alien that Betty and Barney Hill saw. I do wish that we had lovely photographs like that of all our abduction cases. Of course, that isn't really a photograph. It's a still from the TV movie of the case that was made. And the fact that there was a TV movie made illustrates the impact the case had, because it was turned into a best-selling book by John Fuller called The Interrupted Journey. It was serialized in newspapers all over the world. And by about the mid-1960s, everybody knew abductions were here, and everybody, certainly within Western culture, was to some extent associated with the phenomenon and had an inkling in their subconscious mind of what it was all about. So it formed a kind of watershed. After this case became publicised, it was no longer possible to talk about witnesses being ignorant of abductions. Of course, there were some. And there were people in remote cultures who had no association with this, but to a very large extent that wasn't true. And that's happened again more recently, in 1987, with the impact of Communion and Whitley Strieber, and then subsequently Bud Hopkins' success with his books. So we've had another boost, and that's of course the reason why the abduction phenomenon has taken off over the last couple of years. That's a bit of a pun, isn't it? The abduction phenomenon has taken off. I never saw that before. What we are therefore dealing with, as you can see immediately, are problems also of sociology. Another monster has reared its head, which we haven't given much thought to before. You know, we're dealing with this nice objective phenomenon which we can pull to pieces and find easy answers to. But we're finding that there are things intruding into our nice little pile of questions which we don't want and which we don't know how to deal with. So how does the abduction experience differ where I come from in Britain? This is in fact the witness to the first abduction experience that was actually investigated, reported and publicised in Britain. It's a chap by the name of John Day, and he was travelling with his family, wife, three children, home from a trip out to some family friends and relatives a few miles outside of London in October of 1974, when they were in a bit of a hurry because they wanted to get back to watch a television programme at a certain time, and they encountered that on the road ahead of them. They'd seen a funny blue light in the sky, but they hadn't paid much attention to it because it just sort of went by and fizzled out. But then, as they rounded a bend, they went into this strange bank of green mist which appeared out of nowhere. They couldn't stop themselves riding into it because they were too close. And as they went in, the car radio, which was switched on, suddenly started to crackle and sparkle. And John, who was driving, instinctively pulled out all the wiring to cut it off and stop an electrical fire. There was a kind of bump as they came out the other side of the mist. And that was it. They drove on home. And all would have been well until they turned on the television set and realised that not only had they missed the television programme, but the television channel had gone off air for the night. And they'd apparently lost a couple of hours of time. Now, that was the situation as it stood for quite a long period. And it may have stayed that way permanently. They had no inkling that they had an abduction experience, they said. During the space of the next couple of years, they did start to have strange dreams, not just the adults, but the children too, seeing peculiar images, normally of a very horrible face, looking a bit like a bat, with large, prominent ears and furry features and so on. And they also changed their lifestyle dramatically. They all stopped eating meat. They became very ecologically conscious. And there were significant changes of that order. But again, they didn't associate these with the experience. And it was only when a UFO investigator happened to stumble upon the case and thought these things might be important, started to put two and two together and make 22, and then realized that here we have an embryonic abduction. And the first step in any self-respecting investigator's investigation of an embryonic abduction is to cart the witnesses off to the nearest psychiatrist, not to prove them sane or insane, but to magically hypnotize them and bring out the memory of the missing period of time. Of course, that is possible, but what is also possible is that hypnosis can stimulate fantasy. Most people who carry out hypnotic research are not sure how information that emerges can be distinguished between fact and fantasy, fiction, imagination, and all the different strands in between. So you're immediately adding yet another problem to the database that you're creating by employing hypnosis. Anyhow, we have the conscious testimony here, we have the subconscious testimony of their dreams, and now we have added to that the testimony emerging out of hypnosis, which was a standard abduction scenario as the car was stopped inside the lift. They were beamed on board in a different sort of way. It was very psychic, this experience. There was a lot of astral projection elements to it. Inside the UFO, for example, the witnesses saw themselves. They were standing on a kind of railing, and they could see the car and their own bodies down below, as if they'd sort of been separated into a sort of astral self and a physical self. And that kind of element, it occurred recurrently throughout the whole case. When they were actually beamed into the UFO, they did so in a very out-of-body way, that the whole experience had very heavy hallmarks of an out-of-body experience. And also, when you looked at the track record of the family, you saw very quickly that they had a vivid history of psychic experiences. These were not your ordinary citizen. These were people who lived in a kind of psychic world. So the first British abduction case could be looked at in two different ways, dependent upon how you wanted to interpret the evidence. If you wanted to take the UFO party line, a la Mode, Hopkins, what you would say is, forget all that psychic junk, it's obviously irrelevant. What happened here was that these aliens picked up these people, stuck them inside the UFO, and they performed their genetic experiments on them. And they gave them the usual spiel. They were told that we had been genetically engineered by them, that they basically regarded us as their pets, and that they were going to look after us, and we were a kind of long-term experiment. And then they showed them films, as is quite common in these experiences, of their home planet, which was in a bad way, and they wanted to try and help the Earth avoid going through the same situation, explaining, of course, why the witnesses ended up with this ecologically conscious lifestyle afterwards. On the other hand, if you want to be a sort of avant-garde ufologist, then you say, ah, yes, but hang on, what about all these factors of psychic experience, the fact that these witnesses are effectively psychics who have had an abduction? Does that mean that the abduction is just a sort of super psychic experience? Is there a continuum there? Is it relevant? And apart from the funny looks you get from the mainstream ufologists for thinking thoughts like that, you end up going in a completely different tangent, and you don't know who is right and who is wrong. And there's the alien that was associated with the case. And you notice something interesting right away. It's different from the sort of aliens that you usually associate with abduction experiences. American abductions tend to be stocked with these 3 to 4 foot tall figures with large egg-shaped heads, grey pasty faces, large eyes and so on. But that isn't the case in British abductions. British abductions feature more often than not people like this. Similar in many senses to the sort of old George Adamski aliens. They're usually of normal human height or taller. They're usually fair-skinned, blonde-haired, blue-eyed, very Nordic or Scandinavian in appearance. The fact that the alien manifests in an entirely different way in Britain to the way in which it manifests in America is an immediately suggestive clue, because if you look at abduction experiences all around the world, as I do in my book, and look for the comparisons and the similarities and the differences, you will notice that there's a kind of, just like we have national flags, there's a kind of national alien almost involved in these cases. And you have to have an explanation for that. We did a radio program this afternoon locally here, and one young lad rang up and answered that question by saying, well, obviously what is happening is that there are different breeds of aliens, and they're sort of picking out different nations, and that they are responsible for that sector of the Earth, which might fit in with the story Antonio was telling us before about the map that someone saw on board a UFO. I don't know, but I mean, that seems to me slightly far-fetched. A more economical suggestion, which might not mean is correct, but it's certainly a plausible way of looking at it, is that these differences which occur, which follow cultural patterns, are relevant because the experience is filtered through the mechanism of human consciousness, and therefore inevitably, however it's stimulated in the first place, it has to take on attributes of the society through which it manifests. And it's interesting that the sort of British aliens like this are usually pretty friendly, good-mannered, and so on, whereas American alien typifies your sort of scientific technician who is very good at dealing with instruments, getting on with the job, and not bothering too much about what the witness does if he gets in the way of the process. Whereas in South America, particularly in earlier cases at the start of the abduction experience, you had fairly aggressive entities who took on the sort of macho image that you tend to associate with South America. Consequently, does that suggest that there is a kind of direct parallel between the kind of social stereotype of the culture and the alien that manifests there? It seems as if it might. And in fact, the pattern is even more interesting when you look at countries such as Australia, where, believe it or not, they literally don't have abductions. Now, I know that that's difficult to believe in this day and age. The UFO investigators over there are beginning to find it a bit hard to believe, but they don't. They just don't seem to manifest. That could have something to do with the fact that ufologists in Australia are amongst the most sceptical going. If you think we Brits are pretty hard-nosed and we're not prepared to take things at face value, the Australians are even worse, because they are fully into this idea that UFO experiences are fantasy-prone personality phenomena, and that effectively everybody who sees a UFO is basically just ultra-imaginative. So it may be that that's a reason why they just nullify the entire abduction phenomenon as a race. One of the most prominently visible British abduction cases is this one. This happened to a police officer called Alan Godfrey in November 1980. He was on patrol in his car one morning looking for some cows which were roaming around a housing estate on the edge of some hills, when suddenly ahead of him he saw this object which just literally appeared in front, very low height, which he first thought was a bus. Then realised that it wasn't, because it was actually literally above the road, as we saw, and it was rotating with apparently windows on the front like that. Now, all the way along the line, I've met this witness many times and been with him at the only occasions when he's actually been hypnotised and studied by doctors and psychiatrists and so on. All the way along the line, he's been adamant that whatever else is true or not true, the thing that he saw that night on the road in front of his car was as real as anything he's ever encountered. He will never shake his conviction that this experience didn't happen. The next memory, after he actually sketched this thing onto a pad that he had by the side of him to record details of a traffic accident, was that there was a sudden jerk in reality, a kind of jump that happens, and he was now further down the road than he should have been, looking back, puzzled, because the sky was now dark and the thing had gone. And we're not sure that there was an actual time lapse in this case. It's one of the many cases whereby there's good grounds to believe that the time lapse was an artifact constructed by the investigators. That's a pretty heretical statement, I know, but I have seen it happen on a number of occasions where I'm quite convinced that there was no time lapse, and that the investigators, by careful manipulation of the evidence, subconsciously, without doing it deliberately, reduced the time lapse by convincing the witness that they actually end up experiencing later than they thought they had. And this was an instance where that was probably true. There was apparently a 10 or 15 minute time lapse ultimately agreed upon, but it was very doubtful. There was certainly a space lapse in the sense that the witness ended up somewhere where he shouldn't have been, and further down the road, but that's not quite the same thing. Anyway, to put a very long story short, the usual hypnosis occurred, and he came out with the typical memory of being inside the UFO on a table or a bed, examined by these robotic figures, supervised by a fairly human-looking figure wearing a long, flowing white globe, a robe and a skull cap. And the figure in this case also had a very biblical name, called himself Joseph, which is interesting because the doctor and both of the people in the room who were investigating the case were Jewish, and there seemed to be a peculiar coincidence that Jewish symbology emerged from this case. The witness himself wasn't Jewish, I hasten to add. The case is a very interesting and complicated one, and there are many other elements which are relevant, like, for instance, the fact that the witness, when you carefully questioned him, admitted that there were several previous occasions in his life when he had jumps in memory of the same kind. Now, that would have been an immediate signal for Bud Hopkins and investigators of that kind of way of approaching the subject to put the witness under hypnosis for all of those periods of time and see what you could come up with. And I would predict that if that had happened, you would have come up with previous abduction memory. However, in this case, that wasn't done. And instead, the witness was studied by medical doctors, and they were asked, can you come up with any kind of medical scenario which could account for this? And two of them were totally convinced from the tests that they did, although they never actually satisfied the witness to this effect, and they were never able to conclusively prove it to anybody else either. But they were satisfied that he was a narcoleptic, which is basically someone who, because of peculiarities in their brain, falls asleep for a very brief period of time, wakes up again, doesn't realise that they've done that. It's similar in many respects to epilepsy, a sort of transient loss of consciousness. And we began to see possible ways ahead for the subject by thinking about, are these spatial jumps potentially explainable as some kind of actual medical cause? Is there some process going on in the brain which is causing a loss of consciousness, which is manifesting as a time lapse if you evaluate the evidence in a certain way? It also, interestingly, although the witness came out with this onboard scenario, which is very similar in many respects to the abduction phenomenon as it manifests all over the place, he also was never himself totally convinced of the physical reality of that memory. He constantly said things like, I know I saw that object on the road, but the memory that I came out with under hypnosis was different. It had a kind of dreamlike quality. It was visionary in its appearance. And it's distinctly possible, he freely admitted, that although prior to the actual experience itself, he had never had any interest in knowledge of or had read any books about UFOs, in the gap between the experience happening and the abduction hypnosis occurring, which was only a few months, but it was sufficient, he obviously absorbed information about the subject because he became personally intrigued by what had happened to him. And he says that it's distinctly possible that the memory under hypnosis was a kind of vivid fantasy which his mind generated to plug the gap. Now, I think that's interesting to hear one of the best known abductees in the world coming out with a statement like that. In fact, this particular case features in Dr. Eddie Ballard's catalogue of cases. He's an American folklore researcher, PhD, who's produced what is probably the most monumental research into abduction cases ever produced anywhere. And he comes up with a list of the top 50 abductions based on the amount of data available and the complexity and importance of the case. And this is one of only about two or three British cases which features in that top 50 listing. So it is widely regarded as a significant case. Like that makes you wonder how many other witnesses might make the same. They didn't face a kind of peer pressure which they do face, inevitably. Because if you've got a situation where you are taking your witness to a doctor to try and relieve a period of time, and that you are a UFO group, and you are wanting to come up with a UFO scenario, and that maybe you're even paying the doctor for their time, so there's financial questions involved, there are lots of subtle forces at work which put pressure on that witness to come up with the goods, to produce an experience, because that's expected of them subconsciously. So that's another factor which we might have to take into account. But can we explain these things entirely as psychological experiences? I don't think so. I don't think so for a number of good reasons. Cases like this, which are sort of embryonic abductions, this is an incident which happened in July 1975 at a place that I have no intention of attempting to pronounce, unless there's anybody in this room who has ancestors from Wales and knows how to pronounce that Welsh place name for me. No? Good. Anyway, it's a place somewhere in the middle of Wales with a dreadful name. And he was on holiday with his family, he was a teenager, when he saw over the top of the hill where he was playing this thing down below him, which was basically, he said, like a sort of semi-transparent thing with blobs of jelly inside it. It had a very peculiar substance with it, but it was physically real but yet blended in with the background. And when it disappeared, as it did so in a strange way by taking on the colours of the environment around it, the brown earth, the green grass, the blue sky, and literally being absorbed back into the environment. That is the way that the witness described it, which is very interesting. However, more importantly than that, he then went away from this experience, suffering a tremendous trauma, not a psychological trauma, a physical trauma, involving hysterical blindness, loss of ability to speech, physical symptoms such as tension, nausea, headaches, and so on. He was under the care of doctors for several months after this thing had happened. Now, obviously they faced the question of, was some sort of physical disease the trigger for the experience, or was it the other way around? Did the experience trigger these physical causes? The doctors were, in the end, totally persuaded that it was that way around, that the experience came first and the physiological effects resulted from it. So whatever else we can say about experiences like this, clearly something involved with them is physically real. Some energy must be there for it to have that kind of effect on witnesses. And you see that again and again in cases. There are too many instances where there is obviously some kind of energy associated with them, for us to say that there is just a psychological factor at work. Here's another case involving four people at once who had an experience. They were out poaching, and they saw this thing come down by the side of a river, which they interpreted as a Soviet satellite. The reason being, because just before this experience happened, a Soviet satellite had crashed in Canada, and it was very much in the news. So they immediately interpreted what they saw, not in terms of UFOs, but in terms of the most modern imagery that was available to them. These figures got out, usual British alien, you know, normal height, fair hair, blonde, you know, not the type of figures you would get in an American abduction. And they brought out this cage-like implement, and they proceeded to measure some cows in the field. These blokes not naturally decided that they might be next on the hit list, and therefore decided to make a bolt for it. But in the process of running away, they felt a strange force pulling at them, and it was apparently targeted on their nether regions. Did you catch my drift? And they also had physical effects associated with them, the usual thing of redding of the eyes, pounding head. Again, clear symptoms that some kind of energy force was involved. However, you also get cases like this. This is a guy who was out in a farming community in Cumbria. In fact, just a few days before the police officer sighting that we talked about before, He said that these two aliens arrived, having gone out of a UFO, and apparently misinterpreted the gesture that he performed by bringing up his hand lantern, presumably an attack. And they immediately struck him down with their ray guns. I was quite surprised we still have ray guns in modern day abductions, but apparently we do. And that is the result of the ray gun attack on his hand lantern. We took this to a number of physical scientists and electronical engineers to ascertain what kind of extraterrestrial force had caused that damage. And we got a remarkable conclusion out of this. The extraterrestrial force was apparently a ball lamp. I immediately sensed there that you didn't know what a blow lamp is. I'm constantly aware that I'm using terms sometimes which might be British terms. What that is, and you can maybe tell me what the American term for it is, it's something that maybe painters and decorators would use to strip paint off the wall, and it's a blowtorch, fine, thank you, okay. Yeah. A blowtorch. Of course, you could never prove that that damage was actually caused by a blowtorch. All you could say is that the mechanical deformation of the metal showed the same kind of results that would emerge from that. So, it's possible, of course, that an alien weapon would produce the same kind of effect. But the point is, physical evidence, such as it is, which could provide hard evidence of something truly alien, didn't come up with the goods at all. It came up with something which was utterly terrestrial. So, if we can't get evidence from that field, what about evidence from photographs of aliens themselves? I mean, that would obviously offer conclusive proof if we had it. But we have a few cases of photographs like this one, although I think most serious researchers, certainly that I've talked to, believe that that is a tabletop model. I take my life into my hands, I know about making statements like that, but that seems to be a generally accepted conclusion. Or we have cases like this, which is a famous British photograph. And you can see the sort of alien sticking out of the top of the young girl's head. But the photographer didn't see it when he took his photograph, he was just taking a picture of his daughter. There it is in colour, and you can see a kind of space-suited figure emerges. What's interesting about the case is that the camera was pointed more or less straight in the direction of a nuclear reactor. In actual fact, if we're not even talking about UFOs, and there's no reason to do so because there was no UFO involved in the case, you'd probably say that that's somehow some sort of representation of one of the workers at the nuclear plant, which has got into the photograph somehow or other. I show this photograph to leading photographic bodies in Britain where I've given lectures to places like Kodak, and they have not been able to account for it. It has been studied by them in terms of looking for things like double reflections and multiple exposures and things like that, but they can't find an answer. And we don't know what caused the picture, it's as simple as that, but unfortunately as evidence of an alien, it doesn't really count for much. As was this case, which is an American one, which I think was ultimately admitted to be a hoax by the young lad who took it. If I remember rightly from John Keel's report on it, the UFO in the background was a hard-boiled egg, which just shows you what you can do with a little ingenuity, doesn't it? This is a little taster for you, those of you who will be going to Miami Beach, is it, next May, to see Mr. Ed. This is one of Mr. Ed's photographs. There are many others. And the reason why I'm showing it is because, in a sense, after you've just seen those photographs of aliens, typically reflective of what we have so far, there's some sign that the phenomenon has gone through an alteration, a kind of post-Strieber era, and has escalated one notch up, and is now behaving differently, and is offering extra physical evidence. If this Mr. Ed case is genuine, and I still remain fairly agnostic on this one because I've got a lot of question marks about the case which haven't been satisfactorily answered. On the other hand, I am also well aware that an extensive amount of photographic analysis work has gone on and hasn't proved the case a hoax, so it's still in the melting pot. And if it's genuine, then it's extraordinary because it represents an effective total change in the phenomenon. We have a guy here who has seen UFOs repeatedly over a short period of time, who has seen entities repeatedly over a short period of time. And certainly he hasn't photographed up any of the entities, only the UFOs. But even so, it seems to be a sort of new daring move by the phenomenon. As does this case. Now, this happened exactly contemporaneously with the Mr. Ed case in Britain. And this was taken by a former police officer who was walking over a fairly desolate moorland area in Britain called Ilkley Moor in Yorkshire when he encountered that strange figure coming down the little ravine there, and managed to get one photograph of him, and he gestured to him, apparently gestured to him to go away rather than come to him, and then ran around, but this in fact here, of rock, and it went round the back of that and disappeared. He chased it and arrived at the back just in time to see this typical UFO shooting off straight up into the sky. Unfortunately, he didn't have the composure to photograph that, so all we have is the photograph of the entity. So, sort of closer up shot there, but when I can focus this any better. No. I can't focus it from here, I don't think it'll focus up. It is fairly fuzzy. It's 400 ASA rated film, so it's pretty grainy. But as you can see, it's your archetypal alien green figure. Now, as you imagine, an enormous amount of work has gone on into this case. I would say probably more analysis of this case has occurred than any other case in recent British UFO history. Three separate photographic teams have analysed it. The ultimate conclusion is that whatever it is actually there. From comparative photographs of the site, you can tell that the figure is approximately 4'6" tall, which of course doesn't mean that it's a 4'6" tall green alien. It could be a 4'6" tall person wearing a green suit. And you're always faced with that dilemma. I mean, you do have what looks to be a very impressive case here. It is associated with an abduction because the police officer, when he got down to civilization, discovered that the clock showed time was later than it should have been. He was put under hypnosis and he came up with a standard abduction scenario, going inside, given the medical examination, shown the films of the alien civilization, told secret information which he ultimately be triggered into remembering, and so on and so forth. But we still have problems because we don't have definitive proof. But we do, as with the Mr. Ed case, have a one-step-up escalation. This is where I'm going to the clogs. Unfortunately, a copy of Tim's version didn't arrive more than a couple of days before I left, so I didn't have time to film that. But that's the staid, conservative British presentation of the same book, in the same text inside, that is on sale here. And what I've tried to do with this is, as I said earlier, try and think around all these questions that we've faced, and also look for comparisons between the data that we've got. We now do have a lot of abduction cases on record, extensively documented, so we can begin to look for trends and try and find answers to some of these questions. Now, in a normal UFO situation where someone just sees something strange in the sky, we can usually evaluate it very simply. Some of them turn out to be hoaxes. Very, very few, in fact, less than 1%. The witness invents the story based on information they have from books, television programs, and so on. A lot of them, the vast majority of them, 90% plus, turn out to be what we call IFOs, identified flying objects, misperceptions of various mundane things that are up there in the sky all the time. And some of them come under this peculiarity of a term down at the bottom there, UAP, which we use to describe unidentified atmospheric phenomena. Now, we deliberately invented that term because to most people, the idea of a UFO is effectively synonymous with alien spaceships. And of course that's a presumption, because the interpretation of UFOs as spaceships is a theory to account for the data. It isn't a fact of life, or a fact of the universe, or whatever. It's a theory, and we must never forget that. So we use this terminology, UAP, because it's very clear from a lot of these straightforward UFO sightings, and I'm talking about non-abductions now, there is no need to presume an extraterrestrial origin. They are clearly phenomena on the fringes of science. It's very naive to assume that in 1989 we'll understand everything about the universe. Of course we don't. There are things which will be tomorrow's science. And I am myself totally convinced, as are the majority of UFO researchers in Europe, that a lot of the unexplained UFO sightings will ultimately be reducible to phenomena like this, natural physical energies, which don't have any kind of necessity for an intelligence behind them. And they represent one, two, three, four, many different kinds of phenomena which will ultimately understand the physics behind. Now, that doesn't mean to say that that accounts for the whole UFO subject, because the UFO subject is a kind of combination of many different things all rolled into one. And asking a question like, what is the explanation to the UFO phenomenon, is a bit like asking the question, how do you account for the weather? You can't account for the weather in a simple way, because the weather's a combination of different things, like rain and clouds and winds and so on. And all of them have different physical causes. And I think that's what we've got with the UFO phenomenon. Lots of different phenomena, all rolled up into one, with potentially different explanations. And therefore, we now have to face the possibility that the abduction experience could be an entirely different thing. It might be totally separate from these simple UFOs. Certainly we can't evaluate it as easily as that. But we can do certain things with the data. There are two little pie diagrams up there on the left-hand side. Basically show you the number of, the percentage of reports in a typical group of UFO sightings, which divide into different categories. The biggest block on the top left-hand side, we're talking about the green circle now, is some low-definition, lights-in-the-sky type things, the sort of things that we were evaluating in that picture on the last slide, and which potentially could be these UAP. The bottom green bit are what we might call, maybe Alan Hynek's close encounters of the first kind, what we in Britain tend to call medium-definition cases, because they're not just lights, there's some sort of structure to them. The witness sees an object, but the thing doesn't do anything else, it's just a basic sighting of an object. And as you can see, those two things together knock out a pretty hefty percentage of the whole thing, 87% in fact. And various types of close encounter form the other bunches, the cake there. And the abduction experience is that very tiny bit from which the arrow is coming, just 1%. So abductions are a very small fraction of the total UFO phenomenon. We've got to remember that. And you can break down these abduction experiences into all kinds of data, which I won't go into now because we don't have time. But we can learn things from them. And one of the most important things we learn from this kind of statistical work on abductions is that they are effectively a subjective experience. Although there are some cases of multiple witnesses involved in abductions, the vast majority of abductions tend to be single witness events, much more so than UFO sightings. The average number of witnesses per case, which you can get by dividing up the total number of witnesses and the total number of cases, turns out for UFO sightings to be around about 2.6 witnesses per case. Now, abduction, it comes down to somewhere in the region of 1.2, very close to 1, which would of course be just 1 witness per case, total subjectivity, i.e. nobody but the witness experienced the phenomenon, which poses all kinds of immediate questions, like how real is the subject? Because if there's no hard evidence from others that the thing actually happened, you're effectively dealing with something like a dream. Now, dreams, we all know, are real because we individually have them. But you can't prove the reality of anybody else's dream. You can prove the reality of physiological changes in the brain, but the dream is something which you can't analyse because we don't have any way of translating the dream into a recordable medium. It's a totally subjective experience. And that, to a very large extent, is what the abduction part of an abduction experience is. Because we don't have anybody, as far as we know, who has actually witnessed an abduction taking place when they were not directly involved, which is a very disturbing piece of information. Why? I mean, we've got people who've witnessed a bank robbery, for instance, in progress when they weren't directly involved. And we do have some good cases where people who were going through abduction experiences were seen during the time when they believed they were inside the UFO. Where were they? In one case, they were flat out in bed in a kind of trance-like state. In another case, they were unconscious on the floor. And yet, a very interesting case from Australia, the woman who was believing herself and describing herself to be inside a UFO was sat with two UFO investigators describing the experience to her as they sat there in amazement, realizing that physically she was exactly where she'd been all along, still sat with them in the car. So clearly these cases, if nothing else, demonstrate that the abduction experience is not a physically real phenomenon. There may be a physically real cause, and I believe there's good evidence that there is an energy force behind them, but they are not in themselves physically real experiences. I could go on further, but I'm sure I've overrun the time, and I think if we don't have any questions at all, I'd better shut up at that point. It seems an appropriate place to stop. What I hope I've done, rather than solve the mystery for you, because I've not attempted to do that, and I know I haven't, is pose questions which possibly you haven't thought of before. And if it makes your mind wander along different pathways in this phenomenon, then I've achieved all and more than I could have expected to achieve. I thank you for greeting me in your country warmly. I've certainly enjoyed myself, and it's been a very learning experience for me. I've learned a great deal from the people I've met here, and I'll certainly go away with things to think over, and I hope you do too. Thank you.